This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the field for Republican candidates for president is growing, but former President Trump is holding on to the lead in the polls so far. We'll look at the latest public opinion on the issues and the options for 2024. Now, our brains are complicated things. It can be difficult to understand what makes them work the way they do. And that's especially important for children and young adults whose brains are still developing. There are a lot of questions about the things that can have an impact on developing brains, from screen time to smoking to alcohol and other drugs. A massive new study is working to answer those questions, and a lot of the work is happening here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about brain development in children and young adults? If you're a parent, guardian, or grandparent, what observations or experiences do you have? If we're talking about you, if you're a young adult yourself, how do you think about your own brain development? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Krista Lisdahl is a professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, where she's director of the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory. She researches the brain development consequences of chronic drug use during adolescence and emerging adulthood, and predictors of substance use onset in youth. And she's a principal investigator for UWM's participation in this nationwide study of adolescent brain cognitive development funded by the National Institutes of Health. It's the largest long-term study of brain development and child health in the United States. Krista, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Well, I just said it was a new study. It actually launched in 2015, though. Can you talk a little bit about this big nationwide study and your role in the UW-Milwaukee's role in it?
Yes. So this is actually the largest study in the United States history to really understand kind of multiple factors that influence both brain, but also kind of cognitive, emotional, and physical health development from ages 9 and 10 all the way to about 19 and 20. So it's a 10-year longitudinal study with 21 different research sites throughout the United States, and one of them is here at UWM.
Can you talk about that era, 8 or 9 years old to 19 years old, and why that's so important for our brain development?
Yeah, so the adolescent, you know, kind of early adolescent, late childhood area or time period, there is a lot of very dynamic changes going on. So we all know about kind of adolescent puberty and hormonal changes, but what we've discovered in the last 20 years or so is there's very dynamic changes in the brain development as well that are somewhat related to the hormones, but also kind of independent from that. And we see it's both this kind of golden opportunity for society and families to give that last bit of really strong support so youth can reach their full potential. And it also happens to be a sensitive period for the onset for a lot of mental health conditions, as well as health behaviors like substance use. So to really understand the onset of a lot of mental health conditions, we have to understand how they come on and what might make youth resilient to them during adolescence.
One thing I wonder about with a study this length and this size, we get questions on this show all the time about do things like screen time or social media use cause depression? And we might look and say, well, social media use is correlated with depression. I'm just making that up. But does that mean that depressed kids turn to social media, or is social media driving depression, or a little bit of both? Are you hoping to be able to tease out the causal factors here?
Yes, that's definitely one of our big questions, many questions about that causal timing, because a lot of the studies before would kind of be smaller studies of maybe, you know, 50, maybe even 100 teenagers, and they're studied at one time point and given, you know, some sort of interview or things like this. But ABCD study, we can take multiple measures over time and kind of see from time point A to B, did the onset of more social media, you know, really cause depression, or did what we see is the onset of depression causing, you know, more social media usage? So we are trying to tease that apart. And one of the things we are looking at pretty closely is screen time. We do see this huge increase in screen time from ages like 9, 10 to even 12, 13, doubling in use from maybe 4 hours a day or so at ages 9 and 10 to more like 8 or 9 hours a day in 12, 13-year-olds. And we do see some links with mood and mental health between screen time and, well-being, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Talking to Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee. She's part of this big nationwide study. It's happening here in Wisconsin as well, the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Research. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Screen time is one of the variables you're looking at. I want to focus on one that you have done a lot of work on in particular. When it comes to drugs, and you've focused on marijuana yourself, can you talk about what we know and what we're hoping to learn from this study?
Yeah, so what we know so far about what I would call more regular cannabis use or marijuana use is that during the teenage years, if people use, at least weekly to almost every day, they show somewhat reduced cognitive functioning in areas like sustaining their attention, maybe during, a boring lecture or a radio talk show, where you really have to pay attention over time, or their verbal memory is a little bit worse, as well as their speed of processing. We also see some subtle differences in how their brain processes information, where generally speaking, for the most part, they have to use more of certain brain areas like the prefrontal cortex or the parietal cortex to do the same cognitive task compared to peers that don't use. We do see that there might be some recovery of function if people stop using cannabis, if teenagers stop using, for 2 to 3 weeks, we see some improvements in cognition and mood. But what we don't know is if using for a long time during the adolescent years or the teenage years, does that cause longer term changes, that last into adulthood, even if they stop using because they use during a really critical period during development? So that's what we're hoping to study with the ABCD study.
Can you talk about the role of brain imaging in this study? What kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, so we do really extensive brain imaging. These kids, they're tremendous, junior scientists here that come in for almost 2 hours of brain imaging. So we get really high resolution pictures of their brain so we can look at their brain anatomy. We get some scans that are called diffusion tensor imaging, where we can actually look at some measures almost of the molecular structure of their white matter, which are the connections between different brain neurons in the brain. And then we also look at brain function, both at rest and during some different cognitive tasks where they're kind of engaging in puzzles and things like that.
We're talking to Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a long-term national study of youth brain development going on here in Wisconsin as well. Krista is a lead investigator on that study, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about young and adolescent brain development? What do you wish you knew more about, maybe as a parent yourself, when it comes to what leads to different changes in our brains as we grow up? The study looks at things like drug and alcohol use, smoking, screen time, isolation, and more. Have you noticed that being a problem, maybe for your own kids in your own school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Milwaukee psychology professor Krista Lisdahl, looking at the nationwide Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study. Our guest is the principal investigator for the Wisconsin part of that study, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. What are you curious about when it comes to our brain's development in our youth and adolescent years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Krista, we've mentioned this study started in 2015. We had the COVID-19 pandemic. How did your study adapt to deal with it? What kind of things are you hoping to learn about the impact of the pandemic?
Our study actually adapted rather quickly. We relaunched our interviews virtually within about a week of shutting down at the universities across the country. And what we focused on was trying to understand how we actually also, launched a COVID-19 kind of sub-study and survey. So we wanted to understand like mental health during the pandemic, and found a lot of different resilience and risk factors related to improved or more problematic mental health of the youth during this very stressful period. So kind of peak pandemic, summer 2020, you can imagine, where a lot of families were disrupted. There was a lot of uncertainty. There were illnesses in the families, disruption in their parents' workplace, as well as schools shutting down. And we saw a lot of factors that were linked with teenager mental health, such as if families had more routines, like more regular scheduled meal times or outdoor activities, or really just a predictable schedule, the youth reported better mental health during that period. We also found like if they had a lot of moderate or more vigorous physical activity, they had better mental health outcomes during that time, such as less COVID-related worry and stress, as well as more social support and coping behaviors.
Now, I understand you're a parent yourself of a kid who's roughly the same age as those in the cohort. What's that been like for you, you know, experiencing reality as a parent while looking at the brain development of kids about that age?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes me, you know, feel like a very living, engaged scientist, you know, that this isn't just theoretical. As a parent, you're always looking for some advice or evidence, you know, for things that you can do that are modifiable. You know, a lot of science in the past have talked about genetics or family risk factors and things like that, that maybe we can't change. So as a more health psychologist, I'm always looking for things that actually we can do. Like it was really helpful for me to see, for example, that parental monitoring of school activities during the pandemic and having kind of a routine and a structure, especially providing outdoor activities, was helpful at protecting mental health. And that's something where I put my energies personally, because I saw that data and it felt right as well. You know, it was right for me and my family. I also try and approach, you know, this work with some humility. You know, I have only one worldview, and we try and have a very diverse lab and diverse group of investigators and parents, you know, throughout the country, to really make sure that we don't have a one size fits all, you know, recommendations, and really understand multiple perspectives.
Talking to Krista Lizdahl, Director of Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology, the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory at UW-Milwaukee. Talking about a big national study she's involved in, the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Research. Krista, it's still ongoing, but there have been some spinoffs from it and some research that we can use, I think, in our daily lives, maybe in our parenting lives. What stand out to you as the biggest takeaways so far?
Yeah, so far I think that there's, I would maybe categorize it in three different spots. So the first one is more these health behaviors. Like we are learning that screen time does have an impact on mental health. And there's some recommendations to really consider limiting screen time to 2 to 3 hours a day. And if the youth are spending a lot of time on social media in particular, have regular conversations about cyberbullying, both, you know, your own youth potentially engaging in some of that or receiving it, because that in particular seems to be linked with a lot more depression and poorer mental health outcomes like anxiety, depression, poor sleep. And then sleep does play this really important role, and adolescents' brain are still developing, and they need more like 9 to 10 hours of sleep a night. So paying a lot of attention to that, getting increased physical activity that's linked with better mental health, as well as better cognitive performance. So that's kind of some of the more health behaviors. Then on the mental health side, it really seems like these very warm, engaged, you know, emotionally connected parent relationships, as well as relationships out in the community, maybe through your house of worship or through your school or neighborhood, are really protective for teenagers. And we have to keep investing in that. And identifying youth that might be increased risk for poor health, mental health conditions, like experience with adverse child experiences such as physical or sexual abuse, witnessing violence, parental substance use, or prolonged absence of a parent, that those youth seem to be at much increased risk for some mental health problems that have an earlier onset during the teenage years. So that kind of leads into some more of these more community or school-based interventions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just about the individual and the family. We also need to invest in our teenagers within our society by making sure that all teenagers have access to high-quality education and healthcare screening, maybe increasing mental health services in the schools, especially I see a lot of the districts talking about that as their top agenda coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Do you have thoughts for parents, and you could speak here as a researcher and or a parent, on how to talk to kids about some of these things? It's easy to know, okay, yeah, sleeping more would be good for your kid, or advice on drugs or alcohol. Do you have thoughts based on the research on how parents can have those conversations about the stuff we're learning from your research?
Yeah, so for if I take on the substance use question, there is some evidence that having pretty open conversations, especially with youth that are in more like the 13, you know, to 17 year old age range about substance use, making it very clear what the household rules are, trying to restrict substance use for youth and really explaining it in more of this health model, that there's a lot of evidence that substance use during the younger teenage years is related to, you know, poor mental health, depression, anxiety, lower grades, poor outcomes in, you know, being able to get into college or trade school. And that the brain is different during the teenage years versus the adult years. Another thing that has a lot of evidence is monitoring. So knowing where your kids are, asking who they're going to be with, asking if adults are going to be there, it just reduces some of these risk-taking behaviors. Teaching drink or drug refusal skills to the kids. So not the old kind of just say no, you know, advice was helpful, but maybe overly optimistic. You kind of have to really talk through how, okay, if you're at a party and someone hands you a cup with beer in it, you know, what are you going to do about it? What could you say?
And Krista, we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest today, Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, director of the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory. She talked to us about the ongoing adolescent brain cognitive development research she's working on. Rising temperatures across the country could drive more people to the Great Lakes region. No one knows exactly what climate change will mean for Wisconsin's population, but as Danielle Kading reports, the change in climate is already playing a role in some people's decision to relocate.
Right now, there's no room for anything.
Colleen Rooney and her husband, Jim, are still unpacking. They moved to their new lakeside home in Vilas County last month. When they arrived, tall snowbanks blocked their view of the water.
I actually had to hire someone to come take a skid loader and get the snow away from the garage so we can unload the truck.
The Rooneys lived in Las Vegas for 20 years. Rarely did they deal with snow, but they did face intense heat.
You just didn't go anywhere when it was 115 degrees outside. You know, just to walk from your car to a grocery store across that blacktop was brutal.
While it wasn't the sole factor, the couple says extreme heat played a role in their decision to move to Wisconsin. Now some people are asking whether climate change could end up bringing more people to the state. A new group has formed to examine climate migration. Anna Haynes is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point who's heading a committee to explore the issue.
We kept hearing about people are moving because of climate, sea level rise, big hurricanes, wildfires. So should Wisconsin be worried about this?
Haynes says they'll examine the positive and disruptive effects of climate migration and share any practices that can help communities. Climate migration experts like Jesse Keenan say people may seek out the Great Lakes region for its abundant access to fresh water. He's a professor of sustainable real estate at Tulane University in New Orleans.
The Great Lakes are where you begin in many ways, in the upper Midwest in particular. It's just much more mediating changing climate.
Even so, Keenan says no place is immune to climate change. temperatures in Wisconsin could rise between 2 and 8 degrees by mid-century. Steve Vavaris is director of the State Climatology Office and a climate scientist at UW-Madison.
We talk about Wisconsin maybe relatively better than other parts of the country, but relatively is the key term because we have our own challenges.
As the Southwest struggles with access to water, Wisconsin has seen too much. The last decade was the state's wettest on record since the 1890s, and the state saw flooding and major storms. But because Wisconsin hasn't typically seen intense heat, some people argue that global warming will benefit Wisconsin. In a recent Senate Budget Committee hearing, Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson had this to say about a recent study of the projected effects of rising temperatures.
In my own state, your study shows that we'd have a reduction in mortality of somewhere between 54 and 56 people per, I guess it's 100,000. Why wouldn't we take comfort in that?
The study's authors say the effects of climate change will be very unequal. While Wisconsin may see fewer deaths due to cold, damages will be much worse across large sections of the country. Wisconsin saw a net gain of roughly 16,000 residents in the last year, and about half of them came from other states. But determining who may be a climate migrant is complex. That's according to Catherine Curtis, an environmental sociology professor at UW-Madison.
People tend to move for many reasons and sometimes intersecting reasons. And the climate or environmental conditions are certainly reasons for some people, but possibly only indirectly.
Colleen Rooney's family used to vacation and live in northern Wisconsin. Her emotional ties to the area played a role in the couple's decision to move. Curtis says federal census data shows most people moving to Vilas County come from nearby states, but they're also seeing residents relocate from states like California and Florida. She says that suggests climate migration could be happening, but stronger evidence is needed. While the Rooneys sought to beat the heat, they also had reservations about the cold. Jim says he initially moved away to escape long winters.
It seemed like things were mellowing out, but then we get up here and we got, you know, how many feet of snow and cold.
Even so, Colleen says there's not a snowball's chance they would ever move back out west. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a new Mayo Clinic study highlights the high cost of menopause for women in the workplace. And part of that study was done here in Wisconsin. Check out the results. Maybe share your own experiences. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're just under a year and a half away from the 2024 presidential election, but already a growing number of candidates have entered the race, with more likely still to come. Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis became the latest to announce his campaign, joining six other Republicans in the primary to try and unseat President Biden, who faces two challengers so far in his own party. The DeSantis announcement came the same day as the Marquette Law School released its latest poll measuring public opinion on different presidential candidates and some of the top issues that could shape the 2024 election. We're taking a closer look at those results and the field of candidates with the help of the person behind the poll. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the pool of Republican candidates running for president so far for 2024? Do you think any of them could unseat Trump as a Republican front runner? Why or why not? And what issues do you think will be the most important to voters in the next presidential election? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good to be with you.
Now, before we start saying numbers here, one little caveat, I guess a warning. I looked back 8 years ago at this time, the 2016 campaign. Mid-2015, a guy by the name of Scott Walker, Wisconsin governor, he was a front runner for Republicans. He dropped out of the race a couple months later. We're at a stage where things could change pretty quick, right?
Yes, we absolutely are. And I think that bears repeating often and loudly. There's a sort of simultaneous but opposite view here. Mm-hmm. One set of people say polls mean nothing at this point. But another set of people say so-and-so has the race locked in. You know, it's Trump's to lose. These things can change. And as you point to 2015, Here in the state, we saw a huge change as Scott Walker went from a front runner to dropping out at the end of the summer.
But starting to poll now, you can get a baseline and see what changes, what kind of progress is going. How often will you be checking in on the trends in this race?
We'll be doing this every 2 months, every other month for the national survey. And you're exactly right. The point is that we're not polling today to say who the eventual winner will be. But when we look back 16 months from now, we want to have a clear record of who emerged when and what changed over the course of the campaign. And think of the difference between a snapshot at the very beginning of the movie and the whole movie. We've got the snapshot now. When we get to November 2024, we'll be able to look back and watch the entire movie and see how the candidates emerged or collapsed.
Looking at the latest poll now, you found that either Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis were ahead of Joe Biden again in the national polling. Can you talk about what you saw there?
Sure. Trump leads by 5 points over Biden, 52-47. And DeSantis leads by 4 points, 52-48. Those are still pretty close races, and we've seen the lead shift a little bit. Biden has been a bit ahead in earlier polling, but all of it points to a pretty close race. And again, at this point, that tells you relative strength, not eventual outcome. But certainly the Biden administration, the Biden campaign, has to pay attention to this and not take 2024 for granted.
Then looking at the Republican field so far, we've got a handful of names in. I think more expected to come over the next couple few months. What did you find when you asked people, and especially Republicans, about the race for the nomination?
Yes, and so this is among Republican primary voters. Donald Trump has stepped out to a pretty good lead at this point, 46%. DeSantis at 25, and then there's a big drop-off to Nikki Haley at 5% and Vivek Ramaswamy at 3%. Nobody else rises to even 3%. We asked about 11 different candidates in this. That is a bit of an improvement from March when we had Trump at 40% and DeSantis at 35%. So you're seeing a bit of a rise for Trump in the party, a bit of a decline for DeSantis. Of course, just this past week, DeSantis officially got into the race and has a heavy campaign scheduled this week in Iowa and in New Hampshire, as Trump is also campaigning in Iowa this week.
Now, a big Trump advantage in 2016 seemed to be, you know, along the course of the primary, he never had or rarely had majority support, but he almost always had plurality support, consistent levels of support. And with a big, wide open field, that was enough to see him through. As we see more and more people entering this race, does that make it seem like the same thing could happen again?
Well, I think it certainly does. You see the support for everybody in single digits is scattered across a lot of candidates. Haley at just 5% is hardly emerging as a front runner. It's only DeSantis at 25 that gets up into double digits. But I think, again, it's important to realize that in previous years, including 2012, we saw three or four different candidates make runs for at least second place and really rise quickly, though in 2012, those same candidates fell off pretty quickly, and Mitt Romney ended up with the nomination. The other thing that's different this time compared to 2016 with Trump is that at this point, he's polling in the mid to upper 40s in most surveys among Republican voters. That's a bit higher than the 30s or high 20s even that he was typically in 2016. So I think it's important to note that Trump is a more dominant figure in the party this year than in 2016, though there's certainly still the possibility for him to go into a tough spot and slump, and for any of a number of these alternatives to maybe get their moment to make their case and surge.
Talking to Charles Franklin with the Marquette University Law School poll, looking at the Republican field of candidates for president, the issues that could shape this race, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I would gladly cross party lines and vote for a Liz Cheney, Michael Steele ticket.
Thanks for the call, Tom. So Liz Cheney, I don't think she showed up in your polling. I don't know that she has visited places like New Hampshire, I know, but I don't know that she's seriously considering running. Michael Steele, the former Republican National Committee chair, who's been critical of the Trump era of the party as well. Charles, candidates waiting to get in, other people that you polled or didn't poll.
Well, we have not asked about Cheney, though, in fact, some national polling has asked about her. I think what you find there is that within the Republican Party, she's viewed quite negatively, but this reflects the divide in the party where a majority are quite positive to Trump, even if they're not favoring him as their nominee. And Cheney is not that popular within the Republican Party, except for the small never Trump faction of the party. So I think what Tom reflects is the possibility of crossover votes. But unfortunately, in the case of Cheney, that's someone who's very unlikely to be able to win the Republican nomination.
Thanks for that call. Lenny joins us now in Lake Geneva. Lenny, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Lenny?
You know, I think Trump is unbeatable on the Republican side of things simply because all the other candidates, none of them are entertainers. None of them are entertainers. And I think, unfortunately, Americans want to be entertained every waking moment, and it's not policy anymore. It's entertainment and politics, and I think that at the end of the day, he'll win because nobody else can entertain and provide drama like Donald Trump. And before I leave you, here's the ultimate left liberal Democratic candidate's ticket. It would be Matthew McConaughey for president and Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, as VP. And I'm not kidding you, unbeatable.
Lenny, thanks for the call. Lenny, pointing toward, I think, something other people have observed, Charles, is this now more about whether you like this candidate or not, whether they're entertaining or not, versus this candidate's policy leanings?
Well, I think entertainment is certainly a big feature in modern American politics. Way back in the old days, we used to talk about charisma. Did a candidate have charisma? That wasn't quite the same as entertainment value, but I think we've seen that entertainment value rise, as we've seen entertainers like Arnold Schwarzenegger win governor of California, not to mention Ronald Reagan, for that matter. So I do think there is an emphasis on personality. I'd put it in the broader context that elections are broadly about parties, issues, and candidates. And the candidate factor has always been a big feature. Now, maybe the emphasis on what kind of personality, what kind of candidate has more of the entertainment value than maybe it once did.
Thanks for that call, Lenny. We're talking to Marquette Law School poll director Charles Franklin about the candidates in the race for president in 2024, especially the Republican field, and some of the top issues that could shape that election. They recently did a national poll on the candidates and the issues, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think issues like abortion will be a big factor in the presidential race next year? What is the big issue for you, if not abortion? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, with us to talk about the latest Marquette poll looking at the biggest issues in the 2024 presidential election, public opinion of the candidates who have entered the race so far. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Charles, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to talk about at least one of the issues in the race. You surveyed people about the issue of abortion. People have seen it in Wisconsin as a big factor in the state Supreme Court race. What were some of the biggest findings there?
I think the big takeaway is that a substantial majority still say that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. That's 68% in this month's survey. 32% say it should be illegal in all or most. But those numbers haven't changed very much. Back in May of 2022, a full year ago, it was 67% legal in all or most, 32% illegal in all or most. So there hasn't been much change in that. People are still largely disapproving of the Supreme Court's decision in overturning Roe versus Wade, but there's not very much agreement on when during a pregnancy abortion should be limited or banned. The public sort of struggles to reach a majority on any of the options we gave. The only true majority is 56% would favor a ban after 6 months, but a minority favors bans after 15 weeks, 6 weeks, or any time after conception. So you're just not seeing very much momentum there to support bans on a national basis. Obviously, state by state, there's a lot of variation in that and a lot of variation in what individual states have done and adopted as policy in their states.
Let's go back to our callers. Jeff is with us now in Superior. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. If the election were today, like the Wisconsin primary or something, I would vote for Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina. But I think the economy is going to be the number one issue, and we may see a third-party candidate like Elon Musk at the last minute.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, Tim Scott, Charles, you asked about him in the poll. You were in the field, I think, just before he would have announced his candidacy officially.
Yes, and he's very little known. In Washington, he's well known and well thought of, but even among Republican primary voters, we get 72% that say they don't. Sorry, yeah, 72% who say they've. I'm going to say this right eventually. 59% say they haven't heard enough about him among Republican primary voters. It's a little higher among the population at large. He's net positive, 28 favorable to 13 unfavorable. But this is a perfect example of someone who's got a strong Washington reputation, but is simply not well known nationally yet. But that's exactly why we have these long primary campaigns, is so a person like Scott can emerge, have his chance to make his case.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Jeff also mentioned the possibility of third-party races. Now, Elon Musk, not born in the U.S., so not eligible. Also, he seems to support the DeSantis campaign, at least so far. But some people have raised the possibility of third-party runs, especially if it's a Trump-Biden race. There's been some other polling saying people don't want another Trump-Biden race. What did you find, Charles?
Our data shows the public is pretty reluctant about a Trump-Biden rematch. We get about 26% who say if it's Biden or Trump, they'd rather get somebody else. It's only when we push them that we get the 52-47 split that we see overall. But what happens when those quarter of the electorate who say they don't like either of these candidates get pushed on it, they ultimately choose somebody. And you also see this in wanting them to run or not. Less than two-thirds of Republicans say they'd like to see Trump run. Less than half of Democrats say they'd like Biden to run. But when it comes to a choice between their party's candidate and the other party's candidate, the vast majority of them come home to their party. So it's easy to look at this discontent with Trump and Biden and say, aha, here's the opening for a third party. But third parties ultimately have to overcome that tendency to choose between your party and the other party and decide on that basis. And lastly, don't forget the Electoral College. That matters hugely in presidential races. Back in 1992, Ross Perot won 19% of the nationwide popular vote, the best of anybody since 1912. And yet he didn't win a single electoral college vote. And as we know, it's the electoral college that ultimately decides who the president is.
We'll go to another caller now. Susan is with us in Rhinelander. Susan, hello.
Hi, Rob. Love your show.
Thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to offer that it seems to be a direct correlation between how things are polling and the fact that so these other candidates just don't get any media airtime. Like Asa Hutchinson, for example, I think he'd have a broad appeal if he just could get some oxygen out there in the media space. Thanks so much.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. And Charles, I think there is a concern that sometimes there's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We see a poll that someone like former Governor Asa Hutchinson isn't getting polled. Well, then we in the media don't talk about him. And then, well, in the next poll, still nobody knows anything about him. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is where the small early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, have played an important role. There's a big Republican event in Iowa this week that I think most of these Republican candidates are expected to show up for. And that really is the opportunity for these lesser known candidates to go and make an impression. Remember, that was Jimmy Carter's strategy way back when nobody had heard of the Georgia governor at that time. And I do think it's an upside to having some small states early in the process where you can make an impression with voters one-on-one and really genuinely introduce yourself in a way that big states with big TV budgets don't allow.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike is with us now in Wauwatosa. Mike, hello.
Hi. So in the 2016 election, I think the general population maybe lost some confidence in the accuracy of polling based on what polls were saying versus how the election turned out. How has method changed in polling to basically increase confidence, increase accuracy? Have you guys seen a change in method of polling, I guess, over the last few years?
Mike, thanks a lot. Go ahead, Charles. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm anxious to get this in. There's been a lot of change in polling. We're moving more and more to interviewing people who are on the registered voter list, so we know they're registered to vote. We're also shifting from telephone to online methods of interviewing. It's all about getting people's opinion, and most pollsters now will contact voters or attempt to contact voters through multiple methods, through email, text messages, phone calls, sending letters to their home address and asking them to do polls. So all of these methods are changing. Polling was pretty good in 2022, and it was not so good in 2020. And we obviously had a big error in 2016. So this is an ongoing challenge. 22 here in the state and 2018 here in the state was quite good. 2020, we did pretty well here, but some polling nationally was pretty far off in 22. So I think skepticism is certainly warranted, but it's not because the pollsters aren't trying to adjust. We're very much trying to adjust our methods to reach people where they're willing to be reached and offer us their opinions.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you. Always fun.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. He's with us today to talk about the latest Marquette poll and public opinion of the candidates and the issues in the upcoming 2024 presidential election. Is there an issue, a point of concern for you as you start to think about the 2024 election? Or are you putting off thinking about the 2024 election? Still a ways away? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the president and House Republican leaders have a debt ceiling plan, but will it make it through Congress? We'll find out what's in the deal, why it matters for Wisconsin, and what comes next. And we'll take a hike around Wisconsin. An epic event called the Mammoth March comes to the state. Get a preview and find some great places for a hike, big or small, in Wisconsin. That's all tomorrow on Central Time.